And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How you doing there,
Good
Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
We're going to be talking today with Ramsey Clark, the former Attorney General of the United States and also the founder of the International Action Center. We're going to talk to him about the recent violent incident in the United States, what I guess they now call them spree shooting. They have words for all these horrible things. And we're also going to ask Ramsey about the situation, the possible widening of the conflict in Syria, what it all means. We'll talk also about this new weapon called the drone. And later in the show, we're going to talk to Gary Engler about this novel, The Year We Became Us, a story of the Saskatchewan decision to have public medicine, and which led to the Medicare in Canada, and it involved all those great names like Tom A. Douglas and others. And it was a very important moment in our history. But at the moment, we are joined by Ramsey Clark. Are you there, sir?
I am, Phil. How are you?
Very good, and we're really fortunate to have you with us today because there are these things we want to ask you about, like the use of drones, which is a peculiar new weapon, and we want to ask you about Syria. But if we could, we'd like to ask you right off the top about this recent tragic violence in Connecticut, where the President of the United States said last night, well, we have to do something. I'll bet you've been talking and thinking about this throughout your career. You were once the Attorney General of the United States. It must have been your immediate task, actually. How do you react to this if you want to help the President out in solving it?
Well, you know, I heard President Johnson say the same thing after another miserable slaughter back in 1968. And we actually enacted the last gun control legislation in our history in the summer of 68. It was comparatively easy because we'd had two tragic assassinations and guns were the principal weapon of about 62% of all the murders in the country that year. And we got legislation through that was effective, pretty effective on interstate sales by mail order, which was the principle. You could just mail order an automatic handgun or automatic rifle, get it through the mail, which is what Lee Harvey Oswald had done when he assassinated President Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
But that's we're still there. Here's this young guy getting two terribly dangerous handguns that rapid fire and kills all those children, and we don't have the courage to overcome the military-industrial complex, which is also behind opposition to gun control in this country.
Mm-hmm. When you say behind, I mean, could you flesh that out a little bit? You say they're behind it. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, it's the same industrial complex, so to speak, that wants to hype violence as a means of solving problems globally and interpersonally, domestically.
Mm-hmm.
The psychology of weapons as a means of having your way, a means of, the way they put it, defending your family and defending your nation, but in fact it means killing your enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Domestic or international.
Yeah. I just wonder, a favorite argument goes to the American Constitution and its amendments. I doubt that many people read those amendments, but their favorite one is the second, and that's invoked. How do you respond to the use of the Second Amendment to justify a family having the kind of weapons we found in this house?
Well, it always seemed clear in the 60s, which were a pretty wild time too, the 1960s, that the Second Amendment had to do with conditions that existed at the time the Constitution was drafted, when it appeared that to protect the integrity and the independence of the states and the Union, militias had to be protected in their right to acquire and possess weapons. But the idea that it was a constitutional prohibition against government preventing an individual from buying a nuclear weapon or a automatic rifle, it was absurd. You really can't live in a country like that, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't police it, and it's a war zone.
Well, yes. By the way, the use of the language "well regulated," which was the opening sentence of the amendment, I read that to mean that I wouldn't get to have my own militia, right?
You wouldn't, and your state wouldn't get to have a militia unless it was well regulated. it was protected by the Second Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
That was the whole point, but that's been tortured, and the courts have tended to go along with it. They went along with it famously back in the 30s, 1930s, but even now they tend to go along with the idea that somehow or other founding fathers decided that weapons were a sacred part of the American scene, and that is the scene in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't do anything to mess around with it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not so, and we know that, and we haven't gotten legislation through since 1968, but we got through that year,
mm-hmm.
year that Bob Kennedy and Martin Luther King were murdered,
mm-hmm.
And bad riots that summer.
Yeah. Just to last point on that, I guess Senator Feinstein from California has returned to a topic that she's been, I guess, the leader on, which is stop the sale of high caliber or obvious military weapons. Is that a good what do you think of that? Is that a good place to start?
Well, I think you have to start more radically than that, personally. I think guns are a clear and present danger in this country. There's nothing comparable on it like it among developed countries. You don't have this problem in Europe. You don't have this problem in Japan. Or we have, as I'd indicated earlier, it's the weapon of preference or the means of preference for murder. You want to get rid of your wife or somebody, you get a gun. And that's not good for society. It's not good for children.
Mm-hmm.
As we see so tragically in Connecticut, my God, why in the world would you want a society where anybody can get an automatic pistol that you can come in and just keep shooting people and shooting them, until they're all dead?
Yeah. But it looks like there might be a serious debate. But, boy, as you pointed out, we've been through this several times before, and these guys always wiggle out and come back. But I certainly appreciate the remarks on that. I want to ask you.
Well, let me say this last. The culture cultivates it. I mean, look at our movies, look at our books and magazines and all. The love of guns is still a priority in those who want to shape the character of the society. And
mm-hmm.
It makes a violent society.
Yeah, undoubtedly. We're speaking to Ramsey Clark. He is the founder of the International Action Center. That's iacenter.org, which, by the way, is celebrating the 20th anniversary on January 12th, 2013 in New York City. And it's also, by the way, I have to point out, they were celebrating your 85th birthday, so we all look forward to that. And I noticed that Miguel Descoto is sending the invitations. That's going to be quite an event.
Well, it'll be good, I think. We formed the IAC really at the beginning of the Gulf War, and it's been present in all the miseries that have gone down since. But so far, we haven't stopped the wars, have we? So we've got work to do, and we're going to have a 20th anniversary celebration and pledge to do better than the next 20.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank goodness you've done the work you've done. It's always heartening, by the way. I think it's heartening in any society when people do take on the work and they organize demonstrations and register their opposition, because the fewer voices, the worse it gets. And so the International Action Center, that's IACenter.org, is in the forefront, and this is Ramsey Clark, who was the founder of that organization.
We had missions to Iraq every year from 91, which shows we were older than 20 years, 1991, mm-hmm. Gulf War until 2003, shock and awe. After that, you couldn't get in because, you know, we had troops in there and everybody getting shot.
Mm-hmm. Your members of your organizations have been recently in Pakistan and other places where the use of the drone has become a factor. We find ourselves a kind of unique spot here. The drone 5 years ago was not a topic, but now it's at the center of so many discussions. And could you outline what kind of a phenomenon is this, and what are the means of fighting back against the use of the drone?
Well, the drone's an exceedingly dangerous extension of the power to arbitrarily kill any place on Earth. People unaware that they're about to be murdered from the air. Mm-hmm. And it's criminal in its essence. It's summary execution. The judge, jury, and executioner is the CIA, even when the president says he signs off on it, which is a strange thing for a president to be doing, sitting up late at night deciding whether to kill this guy or not.
It seems
but
almost
what's
surreal,
he know?
Actually.
He doesn't know anything except what he's told, does he? How can he? I mean, how can he know? So what happens is he gets a CIA report
mm-hmm.
that says this guy's a member of Al-Qaeda or some murder outfit, Murder Inc. or something. Mm-hmm. The president reads it and says, well, that sounds right. But I guess they said that's what we hire him for.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do what they say, so I'll say I'll sign off on this. And then some real pilots sitting around an Air Force base. We've had three of these trials now. I've been at all three of them. The Air Force bases where the drones are actually, the decision to make and the trigger is pulled is in the United States. It's either an Air Force base just north of Las Vegas or one just outside of the capital of Kansas or just outside of Syracuse, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sitting there and they see this car and they're told that so-and-so's in it, and they watch him get out of the car and go into a house, and they hit the house and turns out they had the wrong guy and they killed seven people in there, or it's his home and he killed his kids and wife and father-in-law who's visiting mm-hmm. or whoever happened to be in there. But that that's sort of death from intercontinental death is most dangerous expansion of violence that we've had, and it is unnerving. It makes you want to be surreptitious in your protection of yourself by going back quietly and trying to kill them where they live. But above all, if there's going to be any hope for law on Earth, you just can't have intercontinental weapons of individual murder based upon investigative reports by organizations that have motives that are not always in accordance with
the
principle or the rule of law.
There's no oversight to any of this. Certainly the public has no way of evaluating any of it until after the fact. And even then, they're not told, right? I mean, because they always say this involves intelligence that can't be shared.
Yeah, we all got the same problem Will Rogers had. That he didn't know anything. He hadn't read in the newspapers, you know. So all we know is what they tell us on things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's inherent in the nature of things. How can we know what's going on in Wizardistan, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Even if we've been there, know some of the people still there. It's so far away and so remote, and it's another sovereign country. It's a country that's been an ally, Pakistan, for better or for worse, because it's been an ally we've been using, but it's an ally that has nuclear warheads.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no place for us to be killing them. I was in Pakistan late August, and where I spent a lot of time there, going back to Zulfikar Ali Bhutto's time. I attended his trial, And people are angrier at the United States than they've ever been because we just come in and we just kill people on their soil. And they don't understand why we think we got a right to come into Pakistan and kill people from the air on drones that are fired from air bases in the United States.
We have a Harvard-trained lawyer who's president of the United States. What does he claim gives him the power and right to do that?
Well, he's a juggling act like every president. He's got so much on his plate. People are frightened, particularly since 9/11. When you're frightened, you do things that are not right because you think they'll eliminate the cause of your fear. He tries to do, which is a big mistake, I think, to pull into himself the final judgment and some apparent effort to make us think there's a safety valve on it, there's a final check. But the problem with that is he can't know. I mean, he's got all these other things he's trying to do, and he doesn't know the names of these people. He can't even pronounce them, probably, any more than the average person can, if you don't speak Arabic or whatever country it is you're working on. Mm-hmm. And he gets these long reports, and they say what a bad guy this is and how he's been principally involved. But what's he know? All he knows is what the CIA tells him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and we ought to have learned a long time ago you can't depend on the CIA for information like that.
Well, another psychological aspect, I suppose, or you might call subjective, is that there are his party and its leadership saw his doing these things as a way to prove that he wasn't a wimp, that they could. There seems to be this new test for an American president. Are you willing to kill people as a way to justify you get to be president? I mean, he's making abstract decisions based on dubious information, but it's being translated in the political arena into, you see, he killed that guy. I mean, this is Noam Chomsky recently used the word moral decadence.
Well, it's an absence of morals at the most significant level, decadence tends to be corruption, it's wine, whiskey, and women, and stuff like that, but this is more serious in a way. Mm-hmm. It's not anybody that's inebriated. It's a cold, calculated killing on information that you have no way of corroborating.
Just lastly on that...
And without a judge or a jury. We used to have a rule of law where you're supposed to, if you've been accused of capital offense, you're supposed to get a fair trial.
Indeed. Incidentally, I mean, in that way, Nuremberg was an advance over this, right? A huge advance.
It sought by a trial to
demonstrate something.
There's no show here. You just do it.
And some people were acquitted there, by the way. I mean, I noticed the piece I read by Chomsky pointed out that the evidence actually against bin Laden as the key guy wasn't very strong, but he said, why didn't you capture him and show that he'd done it? I mean, that's how you get satisfaction, is to say, see, we gave him a trial, we did hear the evidence, and then you decide.
That's the real pity of all that macho show, that they didn't just take him alive as they easily could have. I mean, they shot him dead on the spot.
Yeah. And dispose of the body, which it means no autopsy, nothing.
Yeah.
No
it
record.
Means no memorial where he's buried, and no routing around him, and it's pathetic and extremely dangerous.
Well, speaking of things which are exceedingly dangerous now, we have something taking place in Syria, and I really want to know, get your thoughts on this. NATO has decided to place this thing called a Patriot missile. They have the Germans and the Dutch apparently are putting an American missile called a Patriot on the Syrian border in Turkey. And I notice that the Russians and Iran and others say that actually is an offensive. There's an offensive aspect to that. and certainly it's offensive, I guess you could put it that way. They could lead to bigger trouble. What do you think is taking place here? And do you understand? What do you make of their interpretation that this is, in a sense, aggression against them?
Well, it's hardly the first step in an aggression. We've been tearing Syria up for months now. It's the last Arab country standing, really. It's not one that's subservient to us, as, say, the Gulf Emirates or Saudi Arabia or even Morocco and countries like that. We've taken them out one by one, made a mess of Libya, which had the highest living standard in Africa, now it's got the lowest living standard in Africa. Hard to stay alive. And Syria is the last one on the list of the Arab states, and the last one in the region would be Iran. But we're not only taking them out, we're involved in a process that's destroying the country systematically. It's a beautiful country. It's a historic country. The great mosque in Damascus there is an amazing center for religious tolerance. In that mosque is the tomb of John, St. John the Baptist, and around it, every time I've ever been in there, you had both Muslims and Christians praying together. There are three minarets, one of them's named for Jesus. That mosque would be lucky to survive, and it's centuries old. And Damascus, one of the oldest cities in the world.
Mm-hmm. By the way, there seems to be a kind of a pernicious aspect to American policy in recent years in involvement. I would think of Iraq, where, as you say, ancient institutions and monuments seem to be a target of the very people about whom the State Department has the nicest things to say.
Well, that's generally true. You know, some of it escapes, but a lot of it, there's no respect for it. I guess that's psychologically.
I think of the looting there in Baghdad. People like Rumsfeld thought it was funny. His explanation was, well, these things happen. Amazing.
People try to stay alive, you know. When things get bad, you you grab what you can.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we've poor Iraq suffered since 1991, and it's just hard to imagine living all those years without any sense of security that your home may not get blown up, you shot in the head, your wife, children, mother killed any day, any time. Just sending the kids out to go to school is frightening every day because you don't know what may happen to them.
Well, yes, and again, these elements that are receiving weapons, they've clearly and openly from states like Qatar and Saudi Arabia, are now, they speak of killing entire people, or certainly they use words like Alawi, we're going to kill all the Alawi, we're going to chase all the Christians away. They have said that they will kill Ukrainians and Russians and Iranians. And I notice again, of course, from those capitals, they're saying, you're declaring war on us. And other than a kind of a tut-tut, I don't hear anything from Paris, London, Washington that even seriously demurs from the practices of these guys.
Well, I guess they think the less discussion of those issues, the better. The less people think about them, the better. And they focus on evil, the evil that made 9/11 possible, killing 3,000 people in the World Trade Center, wherever it was. It was an enormous tragedy. And you got to get even. But getting even is not the road to peace, and we've more than gotten even. We're way ahead.
Mm-hmm.
We've knocked off one country after another over there, and it's still going at it. And Iran's next on the list.
Mm-hmm. Just on the issue, I know you've spoken out about, of course, nuclear weapons has always been a major theme. They recently had a rather heartening resolution in the United Nations saying there should be a nuclear-free Middle East, and it wanted to, I guess they wanted to convene a meeting about to that effect, and but Israel chose not to attend, and when there was a criticism of that, United States and Canada, Marshall Islands, I think, voted against. But could you talk about nuclear weapons in that region, and particularly, I guess, with the backdrop of Syria turning into a shooting gallery, something we ought to address, don't you think?
Well, there's only one country that has nuclear weapons in that region. It's had them since the late 1960s. That's Israel. And if you have a neighbor with whom there's friction, it doesn't matter how small it is, if it has nuclear weapons and you don't, however big your army is or however big your population is, you can't really stand up to it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because whatever you can do to them, they can take out 6, 8, 10 of your cities with nuclear weapons before you can get started, or as you get started. So if you want to have peace anywhere, you're going to have to eliminate nuclear weapons everywhere. I think that's the clear moral of it, because otherwise, if the person or the party or the country that has the nuclear weapons wants to be a bully, you can't stand up to it.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter how many rifles you have or how many jet aircraft you have, you're risking the loss of your urban centers. No country can risk that.
Mm-hmm. And I guess a tag on that is there is a great deal of attention to the Islamic Republic saying that we all have to be concerned about them. The two are always linked. Can you talk about it, with the approach the West is taking towards Iran?
Well, they're just taking a demonization, which you always have to hate the country you're going to attack. You've got to dehumanize them. That's why you always get ugly names for their soldiers or for their people. Because you can't kill them if they look like, they got pretty little children, nice boulevards, and happy population. You've got to demonize them. But the nuclear weapon issue is, back in 68, the United States itself signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. At that time, there were only about 6 known nuclear powers, and the nuclear powers agreed in return for the other nations, all the other nations signing agreement, never to develop nuclear weapons, that they would eliminate their weapons. Because if only one country has nuclear weapons, it's king of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
If only 6 have them, they're king of the mountain. Now, if you've got other countries trying to get them, whatever country has a nuclear weapon capacity can't be attacked with impunity, but it can attack with impunity because it can take you out if it has to by the use of its nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So the elimination of nuclear weapons is the only way to go.
Mm-hmm.
If we want life on the planet to endure,
mm-hmm.
environmental problems aside.
Mm-hmm. That used to be topic number one. It's moved down the agenda, but it's truer. It's probably the fact that it's gone down the agenda makes it more important and more dangerous than it's ever been.
Environment, you mean?
Nuclear. In other words, the nuclear weapons used to be right there, and we used to have regular, remember, the meetings with the Soviet Union, and those meetings, we never hear about them anymore, and we don't hear politicians talking about them.
Well, you hear it when you want to beat up on somebody. I mean, the central focus on Iran is that it's trying to develop nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
That's a crime and can't be accepted.
Yeah.
Yet we have them.
Yeah, it's a crime we committed,
Israel,
therefore we
them.
Know how bad it is. And,
we sit back and, finger on the trigger and say, mess with us and we'll nuke you.
Yeah. Ramsey, it's really great talking to you. It's congratulations on having founded the internationalactioncenter.org, IACenter.org, and I really hope you have a great birthday celebration and an anniversary celebration. I'll bet that's going to resonate many, many places, so congratulations.
Well, we've had a good time working together for 20 years, wherever the misery is, and IAC's done a good job. Yeah, awfully pleased to be a part of them.
Yeah, well, thanks
good
again.
Good to hear you, Phil, as always. Thanks
always
for all your work.
Talking to you, Ramsey. Okay.
Rhonda and elsewhere. Love to you, pal.
All right, you take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was one of our, we used to call him culture heroes, Ramsey Clark, and he is, his 85th birthday is coming up, and it will be January 12th, 2013, and the IAC is also celebrating at the same time. It'll be in New York City. We'll talk more about that in coming programs. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and check us out, taylor-report.com. We're going to take a brief break, come back, and we will talk to Gary Engler about his novel, The Year We Became Us.